Hello, and welcome to the Property Solopreneur podcast, a show for property investors and developers who want to build and grow their own profitable businesses. I'm sharing with you my decades of property experience and interviewing many other successful property people who are happy to share their varied and priceless knowledge freely. Business doesn't need to be hard, and nor do you need to be lucky. But as a certified strategist, I know you need a plan to work to. And a good start is by listening to other people's successes and failures. Why reinvent the wheel? This allows us to have a more in-depth knowledge of the wider property world. Hi, just to give you a heads up, from this week onwards, the Property Solopreneur podcast is going to be published every other week rather than weekly, as I'm recording a lot of fabulous interviews at the moment and my thoughts on all things property businesses, as well as completing a number of property projects. Now, if you can think of someone I've not yet found and haven't recorded with that you think either you or another listener would like to hear, then why don't you use the voice note link in the show notes and leave me a message? I love the messages you leave me, and I follow up on every single one. Now, unless you've only just found me, you'll know that I'm a big fan of having multiple different tenant and housing types across a portfolio, because I think it's a bit foolish to keep all your eggs in one basket. You know, legislation and the financial markets cause pinch points at the most inopportune moments, and I like to hedge my bets. Now, there's always one current shiny penny being spoken about in the bazaars, often by those who are new to property as being the only way to make money currently, or by those who never leave their properties long enough to mature into cash cows. And I love a cash cow. Now, to me, a cash cow is something that's paid itself down and only has insurance and maintenance as a cost. And it just throws off the profit month in, month out, totally reliable. Now, I'm also a fan of creating a secure and profitable business. It's what I do with my clients when we work on a strategy day. How do you go from where you are now to where you want to be? You know, using your skills, your risk profile that suits you and that is sustainable. In short, building a business that's for you and suits you, not someone else who wants to work in property. You know, property is so individual. One size does not fit all. Well, if that sounds like you, contact me via the links in the show notes. You know, jump on a Zoom call with me and let's get talking. But part of being able to do this diversification and making sure that your property business is risk-free to the level you want is all about making sure that your portfolio is diversified. And it's really, really easy to do this within every genre of rental property without really thinking very hard. For instance, HMOs. They are so many different ways of doing HMOs. Students, professionals, the over 60s, had you thought of that one? Or social housing, or perhaps single lets. Well, these two can be across a wide spread of tenants. The family let, the professional, the LHA council tenants, or even social tenants. That's the most misunderstood area of all. But even if your portfolio is diversified, trouble can occur. It's never, you know, trouble-free. Unbelievably, the group who've given me the most grief, the ones I've had to take to court the most, are the in-work group. On paper, they should be the easiest because they're in work. They should pay on time. But they've got the highest expectations of what their paycheck should be able to do for them. And sometimes they forget that paying rent is number one and they want other things to be the priority. On one occasion, I actually met a rent arrears tenant getting out of their taxi, lovely and brown, having just got back from 2 weeks somewhere sunny. Now, it was pure chance that I was outside their house when they arrived. Funnily enough, they hadn't been responding to the agent's texts and emails. And as I was in the area, I popped round to check the house, just to make sure really that the house looked okay. It was a very interesting conversation I had with them. Now, I also have LHA council tenants, very long-term tenants. That, incidentally, is what I love. Most of them bumble along with the odd prod needed now and again. And no, I know they don't pay market rent, as that's risen far beyond what the rates are. But they aren't going anywhere. And they were very carefully vetted by my agent before they moved in. And I think my agent has proved to be a good character judge. Two of them have been with me for over 10 years. But I don't know much about social housing, and that is something that is very different from LHA. different rules, and it's something that's very misunderstood and often maligned by those who don't know enough about the subject. So I couldn't find a better ambassador for this than Sue Sims, whose letting agency completely understands this field. Now, most of you will know her from Partners in Property, you know, the independent networking group. And even if you're listening to this long after the Zoom sessions she's talking about have been and gone, it will be possible to find out more about it through contacting her via the links in the show notes. Now, I think if you're new to an area, it's wise to talk and listen to those who've been in it a while, who've earned their stripes, who've frankly seen it all. Now, sadly, I couldn't talk to Sue all morning, but she sparked my interest and I can't wait to find out more. Well, welcome, Sue. Welcome to the Property Solopreneur. For those who've not met you, who are you and what do you do?
Okay, so I'm Sue Sims. And for those of you who don't know who I am, I've been in property for more than 30 years. I've got a very varied portfolio of properties with buy-to-let, HMOs, social housing and SA apartments. So I just wanted to diversify. I've been in lettings for more than 11 years. Set up Genie Homes with two business partners in 2017. And in the same year, again, with different business partners, set up Partners in Property, which is my network organisation. And I also do some sort of like one-to-one coaching and mentoring, which I really keep under my hat because I don't have time to do it for a lot of people. And I'm a really big fan of social housing, but making sure it's done in the right way, where you've done all the due diligence and you know exactly what it is that you're investing in and the companies that you want to work with.
Yes, social housing. It's a bit of an unknown subject, considering it's so important for the economy, isn't it? Because is there a difference between social housing and just having an LHA tenant?
Massive difference. And I think that I would probably say is that I use the term social housing is like an umbrella terminology. And then within that, there is lots and lots of different elements. So as you rightly say, the LHA tenant is where you've just got a tenant who's claiming LHA. They're just living in your property as any other tenant. What I talk about with social housing is when effectively you are leasing your property to a social housing provider. So that could be sort of like an exempt supported accommodation, it could be a CQC care provider, it could be a company who look after 16 to 18 year old care leavers, it could be people who are running a children's home. So the term social housing just covers a massive amount. And where I feel that as an investor, it can be a really useful option to consider is that you have a company that is leasing your property. And the lease that you have is as close to a fully repairing lease as you can get on a residential property. So you'll have, and I call it sort of like it's a hybrid sort of like model, because you rent out the property as if it was a buy-to-let, because the company pay you the rent every month and they pay all the bills. So they pay the council tax, the gas, water, electric, etc. But more often than not, those properties have to be set up as HMOs.
Oh.
So they have to be HMO compliant, because they've usually got 2, 3, 4 people or more, depends on the size of the property, who are individuals that are living in the property.
Oh, that never really comes out in the wash, does it? And by HMO compliant, is that up to licensing standard or as if you were just going to do a small HMO?
Exactly the same, because the compliance is exactly the same, whether you've got 3 people in the property, you've got 6 people in the property, or you've got 9 people, because the only difference that changes on compliance is what facilities that you've got, which is, do you need to have 2 hobs? Do you need 2 ovens? How big do the fridge freezers need to be? But the actual nuts and bolts of compliance, your fire detection system, your emergency lights, your fire doors, that's standard regardless about the HMO, whether it's a student HMO, whether it's an HMO that you're renting out on a room by room basis to working people, or you're leasing it to a social housing provider.
Fantastic. That is, there's so much misinformation and, you know, he said, she said, and my friend does, and all this kind of thing, that it's really good to have that. That's very clear and precise. If you can do that, then you can do this. And, you know, you've You've done a lot of this, so you've been able to see exactly how the differences work and change. Now, one of the words initials you used there was the care quality control. This sounds like an amazing body. Who are they and what do they do?
So the Care Quality Commission are the people who effectively license care providers. So it's like Ofsted. So you've got Ofsted for schools, you've got CQC for care providers.
That does put a lot of people's mind at rest, because the people that you're housing under this system are perhaps not the most advantaged in life, are they?
No, definitely not. But there's only a certain percentage of those companies that you're going to be working with that will fall under CQC.
Right, okay.
So the companies that are set up to provide a care provision, as opposed to like the exempt supported accommodation, they provide support to the people that are living in their properties, and they will be paid by the local council. It might be for 1 hour a week, it might be 2 hours a week, it might be 3 hours a week. It depends on the needs of the individuals. Whereas the companies that are sort of like approved by CQC, they have 100% got people that they are looking after. Their clients are definitely people who cannot live independently. So you've probably got sort of like sleeping staff, you've got 24-hour care.
This is so much bigger than I thought it was going to be, this subject. So it really is and should be viewed as a niche, but it never gets spoken about, does it? You stumble upon this by accident.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's now the new latest shiny penny.
Oh, is it? No, right.
It's like we've gone, yeah. So I've sort of like started property education probably about 8 years ago. And at that point, it was like HMOs were the latest thing. Then we've moved from HMOs to serviced accommodation. And now the latest shiny penny is definitely social housing. Everybody's jumped on the bandwagon. Everybody seems to be teaching social housing is this. I see loads and loads and loads of Facebook ads from companies that are saying invest in social housing. And all those companies are actually doing, they want to borrow money. And they're saying it's backed by government contracts. It might be backed by government contracts, but actually the company that you are loaning the money to, more often than not, are not giving personal guarantees. You're not getting any security. And my fear, and this is what I talk about all the time, and it does make some of these MDs of these companies quite cross, is because I would just say to people, ask what security you're going to be given. Are you getting a PG? Are they going to give you a first charge? None of that happens. So these companies could gather in all this investment money. If they're saying to people, you only need to loan us 13,000 and in 3 years, we'll give you 26 back. So it sounds like a really good option.
It does.
But what is to stop them running away with your money and closing the company?
Oh, yes. That was something I was definitely going to ask you about, because I have sat in on a presentation and I was going, am I dim here? Because I'm being told that this is a brilliant way to pay back to society and you can help the disadvantaged and all the rest of it. But I don't seem to end up with a property. I'm just doing a basic loan agreement.
In which case,
I'd rather go and do it myself, or I need to have a really protected idea. Because, you know, if I'm going to lend somebody money, I need to know an awful lot about them. So due diligence is pretty important, isn't it?
100%. 100%. And yeah, so this is why it is one of, I'm probably on my high horse about, because you spotted exactly what it was that was being spoken about and what was being talked about. There are very, very many people who will take it at face value and won't actually understand what it is they're signing up to.
Yes, particularly new people into the industry, because the brain has this ability to hear certain words and then blank everything out, doesn't it? One of them is government backed or, you know, local council approved and all that kind of stuff. And you don't realise that it doesn't really mean very much at all.
It doesn't mean anything at all. It's because the company might have an agreement with Serco or Mears, for example, but that doesn't stop them closing their company down and running away with your money.
So we must make sure that actually what people are doing are, frankly, being old-fashioned investors, i.e., owning the stuff themselves.
100%.
Then working out what they're going to do with it and who they're going to work with it. Now, I know as an agency, you do an awful lot of this, don't you?
We do. So I suppose this all happens because I was in a lettings business And I had somebody approach me who worked for a social housing provider. One of the landlords we were working for had missed the academic year. So he'd got a student HMO that was HMO compliant. The company came to me to say, would that landlord lease his property to us? And that was how this whole thing started. The landlord agreed. We got the lease set up. They did two or three deals with him. And then I started to think, this might be something that I could look at with my own properties, because it would save me having to concern myself about maintenance. I wasn't going to have any voids, all of those positive things. Tried it with a number of my own properties and thought, yep, this really works. And then I started talking to the landlords at Genie Homes. And then I just started talking more about it on social media. And that's how it sort of like snowballed. So before lockdown, I was running like one day events, sort of like every 2 months, we would get 80 to 90 people at an event. So this is going back 4 years.
Yes.
And did nothing really during lockdown because we couldn't. And we're just literally now getting back onto the, right, let's start doing this again, because we want people to understand what social housing investment really is.
Yes, there's a lot of mismatch. I mean, I know Circa have been going out and going to the bazaars and talking about what they're doing and everything. But of course, you only need to get one person in a room where they're talking who goes, oh, it's a total disaster. You know, short of a fire, you can't get your house back in a worst order. And I think that's grossly unfair. It's about people understanding what they're getting into and what is actually involved, isn't it? Because some of these leases are for quite long times, aren't they? I saw you had a house given back after 12 years. Well, from a landlord's point of view, that's bliss, isn't it?
Yeah. So that house that was given back after 12 years, that just got a normal family living in it.
Yep.
But yeah, they are longer leases. But the reason why, you will have somebody in a room, as you've just discussed, that will shout up and go, it's rubbish, you can't get your property back, it doesn't come back in good order. It's because that person has probably been lazy and has probably never gone and inspected the property.
Yeah.
So if you have a buy-to-let, you will probably go and inspect that property every 3, 6, 12 months, dependent on the people that you've got living in the property, to make sure it's being maintained. When I talk to landlords about these leases that are effectively fully repairing leases, they will say to me, well, why do I need to go and inspect? The lease says they give it back to me in the same condition. Oh, but you still need to go and inspect to make sure they're doing what they should be doing.
Yeah.
Which means if you go and do your quarterly inspections, you will find the issues when they're small issues.
Yes.
You talk to the company that are leasing the property. You say to them, we've just walked around. You've got fire doors that are not working properly. You've got cosmetic work that needs to be done. You make a plan. You make an agreement of when the work is going to be sorted, and you go back and re-inspect. If you don't do that, you cannot expect your property to be given back in good order. And for me, I would say that's the landlord's fault that they haven't had the house back as they would have expected it to be. They've been lazy.
Yes.
And I know that might be a bit controversial, but that's what I think.
Yes, because actually, you know, we are the specialists in buildings as opposed to the other side, which is just making sure that people are housed. And there is sometimes this misunderstanding of what everybody does in their own sector. But also you do have I think there are some hands-on landlords who are just too close to the whole thing. So, you know, so they go in and inspect and something tiny has happened, but to them it becomes monumental. And that's when they start shrieking as well. And you go, well, hang on, people have to live. Things will get damaged. You know, that's what you have insurance for. And that's, you've got to expect a certain amount of wear and tear almost, haven't you?
Exactly. 100%, yeah.
So presumably for these sorts of houses as well, is there an implication for mortgages, for instance? Can I just move anything in on my ordinary buy-to-let mortgage?
No, it's a very simple answer.
Right.
Like, people do, and they'll fly under the radar, and they'll hope that they're lucky and the mortgage company doesn't find out, because if the mortgage company does, you can be blacklisted, and then you've got horrendous problems.
Yes.
Of getting new mortgages. So you should do it properly. You should be speaking to your broker to tell your mortgage broker, this is who is going to be living in the property. This is how we're going to set it up. And the mortgage broker if they are experienced, should then go away and find the lender, because there is a very, very small pool of lenders that will also do this. And it's one of the questions that I say people should be asking their broker: how many social housing mortgages have you underwritten this month? And if they're saying it's only like one, or, oh, we probably do that once every 6 months, that is not the broker that you need to use. You need to use a broker that is saying, yeah, we're doing 5, 10, 20 of these every month, because they will know which lenders to go to. But not only which lenders to go to, they will know what terms need to be in the lease for it to be acceptable to the lender.
Yes, that's vital, isn't it?
It is.
And so presumably, if you've got that kind of problem with the mortgages, you've also got to think insurance, haven't you?
100%. Exactly the same. So again, you need to have an insurance broker that understands all the different types of social housing. So again, they know which insurance companies to go to, because again, there's quite a small pool of insurance companies that will insure your property. So for those people who think, I'll just do it anyway, and for the people that, as far as their insurance company, just tell the insurance company, we've got DSS tenants. If there was a fire or if there was a claim, the likelihood is that insurance company would turn the claim down, because it isn't just DSS tenants. What you've got is the company who is leasing the property, who then have permission to have anybody they choose living in that property. So the insurance company, it's a bigger risk.
It is, yes. And you mentioned a very wide range of people. I mean, there's a huge difference between a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old care leaver to someone who has assisted needs somehow. So you can see why insurance companies and people are slightly wary, can't you?
Yes, exactly.
Now, do houses, you mentioned the fact that they have to be set up in the same way as HMOs. Do they have to be physically adapted for disabilities or anything, or is that another niche within the niche?
That's another niche, but I wouldn't adapt any of my properties up front for that niche. I would be expecting the company that are going to want to use that for a person with specific disabilities, mobility issues, whatever, for them to ask me if they can pay to have the adaptations needed.
Right. Well, you see, that makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And one of the things that I find extraordinary is that there are lots of landlords out there. I've worked with quite a few when I was sourcing properties for people who had realised that they'd got fabulous portfolios, they were earning lots of money, and they wanted to give back to society, but they had tried going down the council tenant route and it hadn't quite suited them. This is definitely a way to be able to do something for society long term, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. But the really important thing to do at the outset is the due diligence on the company that are going to lease the property from you, because you want to make sure that they are doing it for the right reasons and they're not just doing it for the profit. So in Birmingham, we have a major, major problem, because there are far too many people who have been licensed to do exempt supported accommodation, whereby the LHA housing benefit rate is £65 per week per person. The exempt supported accommodation company get paid £220 per week per person. So it looks like there is a massive uplift, but out of that uplift, what they've got to pay, all the bills, the maintenance, support workers, cleaners, a head office cost, council tax. So by the time you take into account, if you are an ethical company that is working properly, you don't have a huge amount of profit left out of that uplift.
Yes, yes.
But if you are somebody that isn't ethical, then you might not put the support workers in place. You might not do any maintenance to the property. So you will be pocketing the extra money that you are being paid, while those poor people that are living in your property who need the support and the help are not going to get it.
Yes. Dare I say it, I feel there are some people who might fall into that bracket.
Oh, that's why we've got such a major problem in Birmingham, because the council, when they're sort of licensing these people, or the RPs that are licensing these companies, are not doing all the checks that they should necessarily be doing. But then likewise, as a landlord, if you were going to lease your property to one of these organisations, you need to do the due diligence so that you can be satisfied that the rent they're paying you is going to be sustainable. You understand how they're funded and you understand how they're going to support the people that are living in the properties.
Yes. And also, I think as a landlord, you've got to know that when you get it back in 3, 5, whatever it is, years' time, that you are going to have the money ready to renovate straight away and go for it, aren't you?
No, but there shouldn't be very much of a renovation cost. Because if you've been going into the property every 4 months, whatever it needs to be, the company should be maintaining the property.
It should, but things get tired, don't they?
Yes, but then your renovation cost is generally a lick of paint and carpets. It's not a new kitchen. It's not a new bathroom. It shouldn't be anything major because you should have picked all that stuff up.
Absolutely. But I think some people have forgotten. I mean, I certainly come across quite a few landlords who focus, because they're relatively new to the whole thing, they focus on doing up the property when they buy it. And then they think it's miraculously that good, except for replacing the odd boiler and, you know, perhaps a light fitting or whatever, until they sell it or something 30 years later. And you forget that, you know, legislation changes and you have to suddenly have a different sort of check or paint needs to be done or new carpets, you know, really ordinary things that we always think about, but they still cost money.
Yeah.
So the money's got to be in the till.
And I think the exact example of that house that you just mentioned that was given back to us after 12 years.
Yep.
That landlord, okay, the house that was given back was just disgustingly filthy, but that landlord is spending the best part of 30,000 because it needs a new kitchen, it needs a new bathroom. There's a major amount of work needs doing in the garden, plus all the cosmetic stuff.
Yeah.
And he, when he gave us the property back, I said, well, I think I might just sell it. I said, well, yeah, you could do that, but it's actually going to, you'll lose more than you're gaining by not doing the refurb.
Yeah.
But also for that 12 years, that family have been in there because the family were a complete nightmare. He didn't do any maintenance because they wouldn't allow access for maintenance. So yeah. Even if you mentally think you probably would have spent between £1,000 and £2,000 a year on maintenance for 12 years. That's 12,000 to 24,000. So actually, the money that he's spending on the refurb isn't that much in the overall scheme of things, if that makes sense.
It does. It's that classic, you don't notice it dribbling out, but if you have to pay in a big blob, you do. I mean, I've just taken back a house I've had out for 14 years to a family. And in fact, the structure is absolutely nothing wrong with it, but it will need a complete overhaul on carpets and repainting and two doors. That's it. But, you know, that's it, isn't it? You've just got to be prepared for people to be able to live because you are providing homes. It can't be a palace all the time. Now, we've been talking about families and you HMOs, presumably, are also needed for this, but as you say, because people are not always living with people they know. What about families that are huge?
So there are companies that will take property from us that are not HMO compliant because they might be housing families. So I've got about 5 of my own properties that are leased to a housing association who have a government contract to house Syrian refugee and Afghanistan refugee families.
Uh-huh.
So all of the time, whatever element that you're working with social housing, the needs are very different dependent on the organisation that you're working with and who their clients will be.
I can see why you're never bored, because this is all absolutely fascinating. And there is so much to this. This is why I think property is so wonderful. It's not so much the bricks and mortar, it's the people within it and how you work with them and everything else. So I'm also getting the feeling that if this is something landlords want, then they need to find letting agents such as yourselves. How do you go about finding letting agents that know about this stuff?
It's really hard. Most of the time, you are going to find that letting agents will just be saying, when they have the companies ring up who want to lease the properties, no, we don't allow company lets, because they don't understand enough about the sector. They don't really understand how it works. It's not just a vanilla option.
Yes.
It's an option, I think, because myself and my two business partners, are all property owners ourselves, what we've always wanted is that when we're talking to investors that want us to manage their properties, that we are giving them sort of like an A, B and a C exit.
Yes.
So that they say, right, okay, yeah, I could just have a straightforward buy to let. It could be used for social housing. It could be an HMO. Let's run the numbers. Let's work out how much your refurb costs are likely to be. And then you can choose which is the option that you prefer. But I would probably say that 99% of letting agents don't understand all the different options. Even if a company comes to them to lease a property to use for serviced accommodation, they're still probably going to say no because they don't know how to set up that rent-to-rent deal properly.
Well, I was going to say that, coming back onto this sort of grey area of where things leech over from a lease to rent-to-rent. And again, one of the things that struck me, having listened and watched you talk often, is about the fact that numbers are everything in this sector, isn't it? Because the number of source deals that are coming through at the moment that don't stack up.
No, 100%. 100%. And I do. That is another one of like my hobby horses that I really get annoyed about, is sourcers putting forward deals that never, ever stack, and they want to charge $5,000 for it. And I feel really sorry, because it's those new people who've just come off a training course that don't have a lot of money that get caught up by these because they can't work out their numbers. And rent to rent is always sold as a beginner strategy. I actually think it should be sold as an advanced strategy.
Yes.
Because having to pay out every single month such a lot of expenses, and if you've never done this before, you don't know how much things are going to cost, and you don't know what expenses that you need to cater for.
Yes, and also the fact is that you are probably more naive until you've had something hideous go wrong, and you don't realise that quite often... Yes, you've got little money in comparison to someone who's going to buy a property, but actually you're saving money to get into legal problems, aren't you? Because there's so much paperwork and all the bits around and about. There's so much due diligence that in some ways buying a straightforward buy-to-let is an awful lot easier, isn't it?
100%. So we have got companies where we have got rent-to-rent agreements, where we have got properties that are leased to serviced accommodation providers. But we will always say, how long have you been in business? Have you got 3 years accounts? And give us proof that you are an established operator.
Because there are some brilliant ones out there, but not everyone is.
Because that takes away the risk from the landlord who is going to allow them to operate their business in their property, because they are then an established operator.
Yes. And I think that touching there on the concept of an established landlord who understands things. And again, it's very, we don't sort of have a bronze, silver and gold length of time that you've worked as a landlord. And I think I was very struck by a video that you did on repossessing a property of yours due to non-payment of rent. And I loved the word that you called it, repossession rather than eviction, because we talk about repossessing if a mortgage isn't being paid, but it's exactly the same principle. And I think many people come into property thinking, well, I've bought this house or I'm doing this with it. The rent's going to be paid so I can now extract my money. I can go on to number two, number three, number four, whatever.
Yeah.
And in fact, it is a statistical norm, isn't it? At some point, someone's not going to pay the rent.
Yeah. So at one time before lockdown, I was probably going through one eviction a year with people in my own properties. That's because of the size of portfolio that I've got. And I just talked about that as being a cost of doing business.
Yes. Yes.
Which I think quite a lot of people would probably find quite difficult. But it is no different to a manufacturing company having done their job, paid for the materials, created whatever their product is, ship it out to their customer, and their customer doesn't pay. That's a cost of doing business.
Yes.
And it's exactly the same with property. But I think property becomes really emotive.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Very, very personal.
Yeah. So landlords don't see it as being a business. It's like, I'm letting these people live in my house and they're living here rent free. And it becomes very, very difficult. And I understand that, because if I was in a situation where I might only have one or two properties, and the rent is doesn't get paid, I've got to find that money out of my pocket. So I'm fortunate in as much as I can be quite objective and think it's cost of doing business, because I've got enough of a surplus coming in from the other properties that can offset that non-payment of rent.
Yes.
And I appreciate that I am really fortunate to be in that situation.
But it's also about understanding when you start as in doing investment property that there has to be a cushion of non-functioning money sitting in a bank account to make sure that whatever happens, whatever gets thrown at you, you can survive. Yesterday, Ed called it surfing the wave. And, you know, that was absolutely spot on, because you can't expect every month to be perfect and the money to be exactly the right and everything else, because things happen, don't they? Some people intentionally don't pay rent and others just don't pay the rent because life is difficult for them.
But again, talking about having that pot of money, you don't know when your boiler's going to blow up and you're going to have to spend $3,000 to replace a boiler.
Yeah, well, I do have a little jam jar for that. I once had four go in 1 week, which was quite an expensive week, but luckily the money was there. So again, I just ordered new boilers.
Exactly. And that's one of the things sometimes I think that people don't think about.
Yes. There is more to being a landlord than meets the eye, isn't there?
Yeah.
And that's why your Partners and Property Networking group is very good as well, because it's sadly you're right on the opposite side of the country. We could not be further apart. I'm right almost on the coast in Norfolk and Suffolk, and you're right the other way. So,
I think our closest meeting would probably be Birmingham for you.
Which is still 5 hours.
Exactly.
But that, why did you start that?
So I started that with Adam Lawrence, and it was because independently, Adam and I had been going to network meetings and we'd met up at a few different network meetings. But I always had the feeling that I was always one of the most experienced people in the room. So people would always get loads of value from me, loads of value from Adam, but we didn't really get the same value.
Yeah.
So we wanted Partners in Property to be where we were never going to be the most experienced. That's still the case for me. Don't think it's necessarily the case for Adam, because Adam just does such great stuff. We wanted it to be a community where property people could come together. They've all got similar interests, because I think property can be really lonely. I think because unless you've got family or you've got friends that are interested, nobody wants to hear your stories of what's gone wrong or what's going on. So we wanted to bring people together where there was a mutual interest. And we wanted it to be a community where people would get to know, like, and trust, and then do business together.
And they do.
They do, 100%. And we're very insistent, really, that people take the time to get to know each other. So it horrifies me when I see posts on Facebook and somebody says, oh, I've just been to this like network meeting, but it's not a network meeting, it's a sales meeting because it's run by one of the training organizations. And I've met my new business partner and we're going to go into business together. And it's like, hang on a minute, you've spent 5 minutes with them. How do you know that this is a person that you want to do business with? Because I always say going into business with somebody is as difficult to get out of as getting out of a marriage.
Yes.
So if it goes wrong, it's really, really difficult. And I'll always remember,
you're tied up financially, aren't you, as well? Their sins are your sins.
100%. And one of the speakers that we had at Partners in Property about 12 months ago said something that I will never, ever forget, because it is so true. He said, when you are deciding who you want to do business with and you want to become a business partner, would you trust your children with them for a weekend? And he said, if you can't trust them to look after your children, which are your most valuable asset and the thing that is closest to your heart, why would you want to go into business with them? And I thought, you know what? That is absolutely right.
Yes, it is true. And also understanding patterns of behavior that can lead you to understand potential problems. For instance, I've come across people who are very with it, very charismatic. People are drawn to them and want to form companies with them. And yet, if you look in their back history, their history is littered with problems and failures. Now, I completely get everyone always says, oh, failures are great. You just learn from them and you move on and you can't do success without failure. I get some of that, but there are serial failures. And there are those who just close down companies and then move on to the next person. And you've got to look for that sort of thing before you jump in the deep end, haven't you?
100%. And again, that comes back to due diligence.
Oh, I mean, property is just littered with due diligence, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. You
absolutely have to get up really, really used to it. Now, I know you've also got a virtual event coming up, isn't it? The big social housing debate, am I right?
Yes.
When's that and how do people find it and what's it for?
Right, it's on the 15th of April. It's online in the evening. So anybody can come along and join us. There's myself, Toby Wild, Simon Kerr, Lisa Brown and Sarah Walker. It's chaired by a guy called Colm Hay, who's got nothing to do with property, but is very much big in leadership and development. So I know that he will chair it totally objectively. And we want it to be an event where people can come to it and can ask us anything really that they want to know about social housing.
Is there a website people can go to find this?
Yeah, they can register. It's called the Big Social Housing Debate. It's on Eventbrite, so people can just register. There's no cost with doing that. Also, I can put some, I'm putting posts out on Facebook and LinkedIn, so you'll be able to get the codes from there. I can send you a link to it then if you want to share it in a sort of bio.
We've just scraped the top of the soul subject this morning, haven't we? You know, and as I asked you a question, about three more popped into my brain because this is fascinating. And I think also everyone who wants to know more will come with it with their own baggage and understanding of what property is about, isn't it? And some areas are needing it more than others.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got the free online event on the 15th of April, and then we've got three in-person events. One at the end of April, one in July and one in September. And those will literally be full day at West Bromwich Albion. And again, I think on those days, we'll probably have six or seven speakers that will all speak about a different topic within social housing. So what we always say about any events that we do at PIP is there's no upsell. We haven't got another training course. We're not just going to give you 25% of what you need to know. We will give you everything for you to make a proper decision about whether or not social housing is something that you want to be involved with.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for spending this morning talking to me about this, because you know, it is a lovely, rich subject that is, it is so important to know and to be fully informed. There's so much more to property, isn't there, than buy-to-let and boring old HMOs of the vanilla type.
Yeah, 100%. But it's strange because I didn't know that until I started to go to network meetings about 8 years ago. So my whole portfolio that I'd built up over 30 years was just buy to let because I didn't know there were any other options.
Well, this is it, isn't it? But I think very few of us don't ever move. I move my houses constantly in and out of different sorts of things because the population changes. I have a portfolio in Stoke-on-Trent and they've moved the student area. That sounds amazing, but the council actually did do that. So I had houses that were no longer fit for purpose. So I had to find something else to do with them.
Yeah.
And I think it keeps us on our toes and keeps us interested and keeps us up to date. So it's all a good thing.
It is, 100%. 100%.
Lovely. Well, thank you very much, Sue.
No, I've really appreciated it. It's been good fun chatting.
Thank you for listening to The Property Solopreneur with me, Rachel Troughton. If you've enjoyed this episode, do hit subscribe and kindly leave a review and share this podcast with anyone you think it would help on their property journey. If you'd like to get hold of my guide for building a successful property business, go to racheltroughton.com/checklist. We only live one life. So let's get your dream a reality through building a profitable property business.